The Hawk 101.5 FM in Hamilton, Ontario.
You're listening to a show called Dangerfield on 101.5 The Hawk FM. I'm Mary, and tonight my guest is Dave Bandini. Dave Bandini is a writer, publisher, musician, and all-around Canadian treasure. He's been recognized in all three of Canada's main entertainment awards, the Gemini Award for television work, the Genie Awards for film, and the Juno Awards for music. He's written countless books, records, even a play, music columns, and is now even the publisher of a community newspaper titled The West End Phoenix. A founding member of the Canadian band The Rheostatics, he also plays in Bandini Band. So welcome to the show, Dave.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it's great. Thanks, Mary. Thanks for that introduction. Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, why don't we start off the show with a song of yours from the Bandini Band. It's called The Motherland, and then we'll come back and we'll chat, okay?
Sounds good.
I'm an angry radical freak for all I've sung. But when it comes to speaking my mind, I've only just begun. Motivated by the agents of truth and love, streetcar tracks go click, click, click. Snow piles up so thick, thick, thick. The winter's here again in the motherland. The ravings of the worst that we could be. No one looks you in the eye for fear of what they'll see. Trucks explode down a government road. They're not coming home. Back from places that I've learned, it ain't worth these torture burns. When no one takes a stand in the motherland. Out by the Russian front, glory pinned upon his chest, but even he knows what. No one wins when the filament thins between love and the end. Nightmares leave me bathed in sweat. Wake me, is it over yet? A child becomes a man in the motherland.
That was a song called The Motherland by Bandini Band. It was the first single from their 2014 release of the same name. So Dave, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show tonight. And so before, in the intro, we mentioned kind of, you know, how you've done pretty much everything that one can do in the arts. And your latest venture is you have started a community newspaper called the West End Phoenix. So it's a home-delivered periodical newspaper. It's got city news, it's an art featuring the finest writers, photographers, and illustrators from Toronto's West End and beyond. You now have thousands of subscribers from all over the world. So that's a pretty huge accomplishment. Is it true that kind of the idea for creating this stemmed from some time that you spent up in Northern Canada while you were writing a book called Midnight Light?
Yeah, I think that's where that's where the genesis of the idea came from, because I was, I spent originally one summer there working for the Yellowknife newspaper. And then I was there quite a bit after that, because one of the reporters that I was working with was arrested for obstructing a police investigation as John McFadden. And so the story became largely about, you know, the newspaper, how it responded to the police and the arrest and, you know, the culture of the paper was kind of really brought out. I mean, there was already so many interesting people working for it anyways, but it really kind of electrified or galvanized that culture. And it was really exciting to be in that, you know, despite the fact that, you know, John could have gone to jail, but so that was such an interesting experience, being kind of on the front line of, you know, community/city news, because the Yellowknifer is kind of a community paper in a city, sort of. And so came back and I wrote my book, but really missed that kind of taste of, you know, being in the newsroom and making news and being part of the newspaper. And then looking around our communities at home and realizing that the community press had largely died, you know, over the last 10, 15 years. There were no more community newspapers in the city. And, you know, the legacy media was contracting. So, you know, I thought there was at least an opportunity to try to start something like this. And here we are almost 5 years later.
And so when you actually came to the process of creating, you know, the layout of what that community paper was going to look like, what kind of research did you do into the format, or how did you come up with the format itself? Did you look to other community papers? Like, I mean, you've traveled around the globe pretty much everywhere. Were there formats that you'd seen maybe in other countries or in Canada, or how did you come up with your format?
Yeah, I mean, sure, you know, over the years, there are, you know, you hold a lot of different newspapers in your hands when you travel, because that's a big part of, you know, when you're on the ground and you're in a city, you kind of want to know about a place. And did a lot of traveling pre-iPhone, so right. I was used to that. But yeah, no, I think we kind of had an idea of what the paper would be like, but certainly with format, we... you know, we discovered that there were still community newspapers, ethnic newspapers, multicultural newspapers that were growing and thriving in the GTA. Mm-hmm. Some of them not even in the city, you know, some of them out in Brampton and Mississauga and, you know, deep in Scarborough and other places. And there's a Pakistani newspaper called the Urdu Times that I discovered a copy of that while I was at the King's Palace restaurant, which is just behind the reference library in Davenport. It used to be the old King Donut spot. And I found this paper, and it was, you know, the pages were 15 inches across, 30 inches if you had both pages laid open. So I did a bit of research and found out where they were printed. And so once we found out we could go, you know, we basically, our newspaper is, you know, 1930s size, like it's massive. And once we found we could do that, then we realized we kind of had a sort of starting point for sort of designing something to that scale. And I think once we kind of had that, it gave us a bit of direction in terms of what we wanted it to be and how we wanted it to look.
That's incredible. And so for those who want to subscribe, you can find the West End Phoenix at westendphoenix.com. They're also on Instagram at instagram.com/westendphoenix. And so, Dave, you have a history with the printed word since you were even 11 years old, I think, was the first time you were published in the Toronto Sun. And throughout your life, you've had a really close relationship with print. Can you take us through some of your most kind of proudest moments, maybe of publishing throughout the years?
Yeah, you know, when I was a kid, I loved books. They were really important to me. I think partly because I'll get that. I think partly because, you know, as a kid, like, books are sort of one of the, first things you have that are your own, you know, that your parents like allow you to have in your room, you know, that aren't your toys, right?
Those
books are yours. And I think, you know, that was really important, you know, and that there was a real bond that I had, you know, with print and with books and with the printed word, and then, you know, being able to have my own book, you know, my first book was in 1998 on a cold road. And, that was just such a huge experience for me, and, just a realization of a dream really in a lot of ways. And so powerful to have, you know, my imagination represented on those pages. And then, you know, and then you realize after, you know, that people are reading. And once, there's two stories. One was, you know, I remember being in New Brunswick reading at a library out there, and, you know, before my reading, looking in the racks as every author or musician does to see if their own work is there. And, you know, seeing that there were a couple of my books, but there was no copy of On a Cold Road. And so I went to the library and I sort of said, you know, I just noticed that, you know, On a Cold Road is not, it's not there in your stacks, you know, on the shelves. And she said, we can't keep it in stock because people keep stealing it. So I'm thinking like, oh, that's kind of probably the sign of a book that people want.
Right.
And another time, there was a woman doing research for an On a Cold Road documentary, and she showed up with a copy of the book, and I was like, and the book was like just ravaged, like
right.
The cover was torn and some pages were pulled out, and it was just a disaster. And I was just like, you know, you should really, like, I was flattered, you know, that she spent so much time with it and clearly had, you know, given it the once over several times. And I said, you know, yeah, have you ever like thought of maybe treating your books just with a little bit more care? And she was like, no, I got this from the Rosedale Library. So, you know, the book had been obviously like, you know, read and loved
right.
many times over. So it was just neat to sort of see that book kind of exist in the wild, right? And see how, you know, people, you know, liked it and read it enough that, you know, that it ended up in the kind of shape it was. So, but yeah, no, there's so many stories of, you know, my life and literature and books mm-hmm. and writing. Like, they're too many to really inventory. But it's been great being able to, literature has been sort of a passport into the world, you know, and this remains kind of at the center of my life in a lot of ways, I think.
Yeah, there's actually a great article that was published in the Globe and Mail in 2018, and it's titled "The Words, Letters, and Literature of Dave Bandini's Life." So I encourage people to go search that out. It's a really beautiful article. It came out around the time that you were promoting Midnight Light, and it asks you a couple of questions. What did you read as a kid? What did you read in grade school? What did you read in high school? What did you read in university? What are you reading now? And it's just a really great kind of snapshot maybe into some of your influences and inspirations throughout the years. We referenced just before, we were talking about On a Cold Road, and that kind of from you were writing for, I believe, the Toronto Star at the time, and that was during your tour with the Tragically Hip. And I read that you were writing the bits of it on a portable typewriter and then faxing it out from pieces out from gas stations along the road. And so at the time you were writing for a paper publication, and had you thought about writing books before? Like, had your mind ever kind of thought, okay, when do you want to write a book? Or did that kind of stem from the reactions that you had writing columns?
Yeah, I'd always wanted to, but, you know, I didn't know how to really,
mm-hmm.
you know, I didn't really know how to put together a book, like a long form book. And so there's, you know, it's a bigger mountain than, you know, than writing stories and articles and essays and whatever. So, and also how do you get published? Like, just that
right.
kind of, that riddle, is really hard to solve on your own. But yeah, I was writing for the Star at the time, and then, you know, I had a column in the paper for a couple of years, and I would have to, that was just in like 92, 93. So it was when, you know, the Rio Statics were touring a ton, and, you know, I would have to, I told the Star, I was like, well, you know, I'm going away for 3 weeks, I'm going on tour. And they were like, keep writing, just like figure out a way to get the copy to us. So I had a portable, typewriter that I brought with me, and I would write my columns. And then you're right, I would find whatever town we were staying in, you know, luckily, like a lot, some of the clubs, you know, would have like a fax machine in the office, the promoter's office. So I would go in there and I would fax and stuff, and just got really good at multitasking, I guess, kind of from that, because, you know, gigging and writing and stuff. And then the Hip Tour happened, and then they were like, you know, they were pretty excited, I think, for me to be doing dispatches from the road, you know, in that context, you know, because of the Hip being who they were. And so I did a tour diary for them, a kind of condensed tour diary. And that was good, because that ended up being my proposal for On a Cold Road. So Paul Quarrington's agent approached me, and sort of, it's kind of his idea. You know, he was like, you ever thought about developing this? And I was like, sure. So he was able to get into the hands of publishers, and it was nice. We had three or four publishers that were interested. And then I ended up signing with McClelland and Stewart. Have pretty much been my house publisher for, geez, like 25 years now. And Midnight Light was a McClelland and Stewart book as well. So, it was so beautiful, but different times. Like, I remember I was promoting On a Cold Road at Book Expo in, like, I guess 99, maybe later in 98. It's where all the book buyers come together, and they have events and stuff too, but all the literary communities, Canada, is all in one spot. And I remember publisher Doug Gibson, former publisher of McClelland and Stewart, you know, kind of came up and congratulated me on a Cold Road, and sort of said, well, what do you want to write about next? And I sort of said offhandedly, I was like, well, I think I'd like to go around the world and play hockey, you know, and all these places where the game is just kind of starting. Yeah. And he was like, oh, well, that would be great. That would be bad. Let's make that your next book. And, you know, I remember like saying to somebody is this how easy it is? Like, is a publisher just so, and the truth of the matter is kind of was that at the time. And, and now, you know, now when you have to, you know, propose a book to a publisher, you have to, you know, submit like 50 pages or more of writing and a whole marketing outline. And, and so I kind of really miss those innocent days, I think, where it was kind of less controlled by marketing and sales, you know, and it was more just kind of impulse and you know, trust in the author. And certainly I wouldn't, you know, have had the sustained career that I did had I not, you know, been working with people who really just kind of believed that, you know, whatever idea I came up with, it would result in a book that people wanted to read.
And when you're writing, so you mentioned before, you know, you're writing when you're traveling around the world in all these different places, you're writing when you're on tour. Are you someone that can kind of block out the world around you and focus, or do you need to be kind of in a room by yourself? Can you write, you know, in cafes? Like, what's your process like for when you're actually putting pen to paper, or, you know, pen to ink?
Yeah, I was never, and I think because of music, you know, I was never one that had to be, you know, in a writer's room or had to be, you know, I just couldn't. I couldn't, you know, I didn't have the ability to seal myself off, you know, in privacy and comfort, you know, to work on what I was doing. I had to do it while other things were happening, while I had other responsibilities, and while, you know, even in really noisy circumstances, you know, whether it was in the, you know, the you know, the dressing room of a club or something, or, you know, in a van, or, but those times were important too, and they worked really well because I was able to step outside of, you know, that life and those circumstances, right? To kind of just spend some, I was able to seal off the kind of the private, you know, meditative, creative times for myself in that environment. And I'm glad I was able to learn that skill early on, because it means that whenever I need to write or have to write, I can just sort of drop what I'm doing and do it, as opposed to, and I think it's getting a little bit different as things are just kind of like just generally busier with me and with family and stuff too. But for sure. And I think the same is true really with all of the guys in the band, like, you know, especially when it comes to songwriting too, like when you're on the road, like unless you can, you know, if you're waiting for time to be alone, to be creative, then you're not getting anything done. Like you have to be creative, you know, while being active, I guess, if that makes sense. So you have to, you have to be able to, you know, tap the top of your head and rub your stomach at the same time. You have to be able to be dexterous, right? And that's a big part of it.
And you've actually parlayed a lot of that kind of like lessons into some great experiences as well. So you had a musician in residence role in 2019 at the Toronto Public Library. I've actually attended even some of your writers' workshops. There was a great one that you did about a year and maybe 2 years ago now, but at BMO Stacked, that my dad and I attended. And so I think that's really helpful for people who almost don't know where to begin. You know, some people have stories within them, but there is that kind of, you know, how do I start? And so you even offer, so for those that want to check out Dave's writer's workshop, if you go to instagram.com/WestEndPhoenix, you'll see that Dave offers some one-on-one writer's workshops as well. And all the proceeds go to the West End Phoenix. So that's a pretty cool thing to pass on to your talent. So it's much appreciated. And so kind of back to the West End Phoenix now. So you've got a really cool issue coming up. And so it's going to print at the start of August, and it's your summer music issue. So it's a look at new wave music in the West End from 79 to 82. So I've read that you've got some great contributors to that. Michael Chabon, who's a Pulitzer Prize writer for fiction, as well as from the music side of things, the B-Girls, who were a band from the 70s who've opened at The Clash for the famous O'Keefe Center gig when the riot broke out. How do you plan these issues? So, like, can you take us through maybe, like, the process of the one that's coming up next that people can still subscribe to in order to receive? What does that look like? How far in advance do you plan these out? How do you pull in people to contribute? What's that like?
Yeah, we'll usually, like, sit down and kind of and sketch out the year, you know, the year's publishing cycle, which is, you know, around 8 or 9 issues. And we have our first 3 planned for October, November, December already ready. And, you know, because we're a relatively small team, it's important for us to kind of get, be just a bit more secure in terms of the direction of those issues. And also some of the writing takes a little bit of a longer timeline. So if we can assign some work, you know, now, you know, in fact, that's happening like this afternoon. Some stuff is being assigned. We can give people a long time to spend working on it. And so if a story comes out in, you know, November, December, that requires, you know, months of research and work, then they can start to figure that out. We're not at the stage where we can kind of make it up as we go along, really. I think that was for the first couple of years, and now we just need to be a little bit more locked in. With the summer, one of the reasons I do the summer issue is because it gives our editorial staff a little bit of time to breathe. You know, and a regular issue, they're working with, you know, dozens and dozens of writers, you know, and it's a lot. So they just have to deal with me here. And, you know, because I have a lot of experience, you know, it's a little bit easier for them to kind of navigate the work that I'm going to submit, you know, based on one sort of subject. So, so that's kind of why we do that. And also, you know, the summer issue isn't really a place for hard news. You know, it's more kind of long reads about one subject. You know, and hopefully the writing has depth, you know, and drama, but it tilts a little bit more to the light side as opposed to, you know, more serious kind of heavy issues that we generally address in the paper. So, and it gives me a chance to kind of stretch out a little bit as well. I don't write as much for the paper as time will allow me to. So, it's good to kind of pour, like, I'll think of the idea for the summer issue, like at Christmas, and then I'll sort of start to peck away at it before it comes out. But it's always a real, I love that, I also that I get to write for the paper that I publish. You know, it's you know, since so much of my time is spent fundraising, honestly, you know, I'm able to kind of keep that kind of creative, those creative wheels moving, you know, unless I become, you know, purely, you know, just all that a publisher demands. Right. It's also good to have, like, you know, a writerly aspect that keeps me honest, I think.
Yeah. And there's so much of, I mean, there's a lot to dig into with that paper, because it's, I mean, you've got, as you mentioned, you've got your long form, you really explore all the different types of artists within the city as well. So whether it's illustrators, you know, you've got some great to it as well, like the calendar that you put out. And, you know, I think that it's a piece of art in itself. And I always love getting it in the mailbox. And so maybe let's take a minute. So the upcoming issue kind of talks around the era of the 80s. So maybe let's listen to a song of yours off your first 7-inch that came out in 82 by the Rheostatics. Maybe let's listen to the song My Generation, and then we'll come back and we'll chat, okay? My Generation by the Rheostatics. Dave Bandini of the Rheostatics is joining me tonight on Dangerfield. The song we just heard was off their 1982 debut 7-inch single, and it's an extremely rare vinyl release now. So when it's the sound on that, it's two songs, My Generation and Satellite Dancing, and it features your original lineup of Bandini, Vesely, Crosby, and Clark. And it's been described as the track sound like a cross between Devo and Stomping Tom. And so Yeah, it was pretty cool to discover that. It was really nice to hear. And so what was that like when you put out your first 7-inch single? What was that experience like for you?
There's a lot of, the keyboard player on that song was Dave Crosby, who was our friend that we went to Kipling Collegiate with, mm-hmm. who was our best friend, kind of. We had our little friends group at school, and he played the synthesizer. I write a lot about him in this memoir, because I write a lot about the synthesizer and what, you know, how it really had its moment in that time frame, where like every young band, every kind of high school band, kids band had a synthesizer player, and how unusual it was. But those were the first few times going in the recording studio, which were huge events. You know, you get a chance to go into a studio. They're massive. Like, they're such strange places of, you know, to begin with, you know, their studios. And I'm sure it's the same is true today, but like, and probably more so with like portable recording equipment, you know, and digital technology, but you know, studios would be like in the back of an alley. There'd be a studio in Ossington, or, you know, above like a bake shop on Dufferin was another place. And this place was like in Scarborough, in like a strip mall. But you know, you're in there, everything about setting the microphones up to record the drums, and the massive like recording console, and, you know, hearing yourself back through those speakers, like massive speakers. You know, usually before then, you know, as a band, you know, you wouldn't really demo. Like, you just didn't have the technology. There was no like home demoing, right?
Right.
You'd play your song into a tape recorder, and then you'd listen to it back. But so, you know, the first time you would like lay tracks down in the studio and hear yourself coming back through those big studio speakers was terrifying in a lot of ways, you know, but it was a real achievement to get into the studio. And, we recorded a couple of songs that first time. And then, you know, shoot forward, you know, years later, we were at, you know, Compass Point Studios in the Bahamas, and, you know, recording, we were recording, you know, where AC/DC made Back in Black and the Talking Heads, their first few records, and Remain in Light, and, you know, the B-52s first. But we, you know, when we got to the studio, we asked the recording engineer where Bob Marley sang Redemption Song, which is, he recorded there as well, and he pointed to the space, you know, on the recording console floor, and that's where we set up our vocal booth. That's where we did our vocals. And, you know, you'd go to the amp closet and, you know, pull out an amp that Jimi Hendrix had used, Dan Electro amp that Jimmy Page had used on the second Led Zeppelin album. You'd pull that out and you'd try a track. Like, so it was just so great to, you know, go from that point to that other point, you know, to get there. And even just the idea of, you know, the importance in the, you know, the, we were, you know, flying to Compass Point, you know, to make our record, like that, none of that was lost on us. Like, we really, you know, we were never blasé about it. You know, we really treasured it and valued it, you know, really to a fault. You know, we were there. This is for Introducing Happiness, our fourth record. When we were there for 21 days, I think, and we recorded 17 songs. So we were working all the time. So it wasn't like we were, you know, lounging by the pool and playing, pretending to be rock stars. We went down there to work. And it was such a privilege to be able to work in a studio like that. And our life, you know, in studios has been fascinating and really, really fun. And some of the best times, really.
Introducing happiness. Happy, yes. Look who's found you someone. Look who stole you from your nest. And in thieving
Archiving your personal history. So you've got, you know, you've got such a range of everything. So you've got, you know, from writing since the time you were a kid or a teenager for publications, you know, where you were interviewing like crazy people at the time, like the Ramones and like REM and all of that. Like, and then you've got all your, I'm sure, demos and stuff. Like, are you someone who kind of enjoys the process of kind of archiving stuff? Do you still have old merch? Like, what's that like? Or what do you,
I'm not sure. What do you mean exactly?
So I kind of mean like, if like, do you have a book, for example, where you have maybe all of your a scrapbook, like that kind of thing?
Yeah. No. I mean, like I have boxes and boxes filled with notebooks, but
yeah.
And tapes. In fact, we're really lucky. Rheostatics have a dedicated archivist who is digitally transferring all of our stuff, and he spends, you know, a lot of his time going through all the tapes and documenting an inventory. So I couldn't do that, nor could I kind of find the time to do that, because I'm always trying to point to the next thing as opposed to dwelling on other things, you know. And I think you can paint yourself into a corner a little bit if you just, you know, try to ride on the back of something that's already been created. I think you want to sort of look to what the next, you know, project is, whether it's a book or an album or a movie or a issue of the paper. Like, that keeps it really exciting. I've got to be careful to not trade on past achievements.
Right.
And I think you just kind of atrophy a little bit, you know. Yeah.
And how involved are you kind of, so obviously you're, you know, prolific in writing, and how linked are you with kind of the visual aspect of this thing? So are you someone who really cares about, like, if you're creating a video, let's just say for a song, do you have a lot of input into that visual direction? And as well with your paper, are you someone who has that kind of visual aesthetic sense as well as literary?
Well, no. I think, you know, with the paper, we all, like, we have our art directors, Alicia Kowaleski, and a lot of it is left up to her, but I think if, you know, we have seen something we like aesthetically, whether it's a layout or a work of art or just kind of a perspective or an approach visually, we'll you know, include that in the discussion. So a little bit, but it's no, I you know, it's not real. It's not my area of creativity. So
your relationship with technology. So are you someone who has embraced kind of the, you know, let's just say like the digital age, or was it something that you resisted? Like, you seem pretty online savvy from what I've seen. Is that something that is exciting to you as a new discovery, or is it, or can you talk a little bit about that?
I think it's probably a bit of both, you know, like I think there's, you know, I do think I miss, you know, I think we just have less time to spend, you know, in our own imaginations, you know, like our imaginations are kind of, you know, they're represented, you know, to countless others, you know, dozens and dozens of times a day through social media. Mm-hmm. And I think I sort of, you know, it's a sort of the fast food of imagination, you know, as opposed to letting something really kind of stew for a long time, you know, and then sort of shown or revealed or expressed when it's ready. So I think I miss a little bit of that, but I am built for speed a little bit too. Like, I like creating things quickly, and I kind of like the instant nature of creating. 'Cause sometimes if you wait too long, then you sort of talk yourself out of the original idea or, you know, perspective that you came up with. So, you know, I'm by turns like frustrated by it as well as encouraged or excited by it too. I really kind of toggle back and forth, and I'm not really entirely sure where I stand.
Yeah. So for those just joining, you're listening to Dangerfield on 101.5 The Hawk FM, and I'm joined tonight by Dave Bandini. You can find him online at instagram.com/DaveBandini, and you can also find his paper at westendphoenix.com. His music is available for purchase at zunier.com. You can find his music by the Rhythmstatics and Bandini Band there. Dave, so in your process of creating the newspaper, the West End Phoenix, have you written any songs that have come out of maybe some of the stories that you've come across, or has that influenced any of your songwriting at all? Or
No, I don't think so. No, those are two pretty different things. So yeah. Nope, I wouldn't say that's been the case at all.
Yeah, and would you say that your creative process for writing a song, are there any similarities between that and how you write an article or write a book?
They're pretty good. I mean, I think they're cousins. They're related.
Yeah.
Part of the same family. But, you know, yeah, I think they're related. They come from the same place.
Yeah. I'm always curious about, like when people are great lyricists as you are, like when, if the majority of your songs you kind of write, does the melody come first or does did the words, or does it really just depend on the song?
It really does. I mean, you can just kind of get like the idea of, you know, a title in mind, and that can kind of inform the direction that the song is going to take. And sometimes you'll just come up with a little kind of lick on the guitar, a little figure on the guitar, and then that will, you know, grow into something musical. Then you fit the lyrics into that. It really depends. It's very different song to song, I would say.
Okay. Well, maybe let's listen to another song of yours. Let's listen to my first rock concert. It's off the Rheostatics album, The Blue Hysteria, the 1996 album, and we'll come back and we'll chat.
Cut in a nice play made by the defenseman, and Wooly makes
my first rock concert was a stadium of fair. Our dads drove us down to the front gates there, and we looked at all the people in first time I smelled dope in the air, and we saw yellow, but they sucked. But Meatloaf was wicked, so he gave it up for that man.
Gave it up for me.
Hey, you ain't missed nothing there, baby.
My second rock show was offered some pot, but I refused to be swayed or to be caught by a cop. Getty, Alex, Neil, they played penultimate rock, and for the very last song they set off five flash pods, my friends, at an epileptic fit. But the crowd cheered him on, cause they thought that he was dancing.
Thought that he was on his back.
My third rock show was an epochal day. It was outside of the Explore the Alpine Wave. Aerosmith and Gatto, they were okay, but when I saw the Ramones, it changed the way I saw the world. I saw everything. So I bought a leather jacket, cat holes in my jeans. And my parents saw my pants, and they took away the car keys. The Specials, Gang of Four, and all the new wave. I saw the birthday party play with Nick Cave. I saw XTC twice. I thought Paul Weller was Christ. I even met Michael Stipe. He was distant, but he was nice. Joe Jackson saved my life. How did Kamensky miss that? At Massey Hall, I got up and I started to dance. Big old cop, he grabbed me and he pinned me against the stage. It's many years later and I'm up on the stage. Sometimes I feel a little like a bird in a cage. Under these lights you're either a mouse or a sage. Music belies one's actual age. Is it just a passing turn? Yeah, could be, could be. Like a rusted car, hairstyle on an old shirt. Shirt, shirt. Chum chart, an 8-track, or a gatefold double live. Oh yeah, I was there.
Why, thank you. Why, thank you.
Sensational tonight. Absolutely. That's the 100th shot by these two teams.
That was my first rock concert by the Rio Statics. Dave Bandini from that band, who's also writer, musician, and publisher, joins me tonight on Dangerfield. So, Dave, I always love reading about your writing about just things that are very music related. Obviously, being a big music fan myself, and there's a great article I read about, and it was about you putting together a mixtape. So it was for your wife, and it was around the time I think you're probably pretty young. You were dating for like 3 years, I think it said, and it talks just about, it really, it captures the you know, the thought process and the kind of the work involved in creating a mixtape. How do you listen to music now? Like, how do you take in music? Are you someone who listens to a lot of radio? Do you buy vinyl? Like, how do you take in music these days?
I think it's like, it's every way, really. Yeah. It is, you know, from the most arcane technology to the you know, the newest way, you know, whether it's, you know, I have a jukebox in our garage, I listen to music when I'm out there that way. And, but, you know, when I'm in our, you know, and in the car, it's CDs sometimes, and then it's, but also on, you know, on Apple Music and digitally too, like, and we have also have a turntable at home, and you know, every, I think that's the, one of the great things in a way about the time in which we live. Like, there's so many different ways of listening to music, and I think they all have their own sort of charm, you know, and, you know, sometimes you love the kind of instantaneous, just hit a button and you can find any song that you want is out there, but also like the search for, you know, looking in through your album racks to find that double album that you haven't listened to for 25 years and finding it and then putting it on and how great it sounds coming through the speakers from the turntable. And, you know, I'll load different records into my jukebox, you know, to sometimes based on different themes or whatever. And I love doing that too. And the sensation of just like, you know, chunking in those numbers off the,
yeah,
panel on the jukebox and then them, you know, slithering into their chassis and then on the platter and then the needle on the record, like, that's great too. And yeah, I try to embrace all formats, really.
That's pretty awesome. You have a jukebox. When and how did you get that? That's a pretty neat.
Got it when I turned 50. I got it for my 50th birthday, and I got it. Yeah, I found it on Kijiji, I think. Some dude in Cambridge, and it was beautiful. It was 1973. It was in a hardware store in Montreal, and originally, and I'd gone and looked at other jukeboxes, but they were just way too expensive and way too beautiful, frankly, and they're prohibitively expensive. But I think this jukebox cost me $300, and
that's it.
You know, I loaded it in the back of Don Kerr's Taurus and brought it home, and yeah, it's great. I have a jukebox repair person who's a 73-year-old Belgian, Maurice, and he comes once a year and fixes it in the garage, and it's a joy. It's really beautiful thing.
Cool. Well, Dave, I want to thank you so much for your time today. I think we're coming up on time soon, but and I'll probably play maybe one or two more songs off your music to end off the show. It's been really interesting talking to you tonight and just kind of learning more about your creative process and your influences and what's inspired you over the years. And as you know, I've been a big fan of your writing and your music for, I guess, 30 years now. So it's been a pleasure to have you on my show tonight. So I just want to thank you so much for your time. And I hope a great night.
Well, yeah, thanks. So finally, I'm glad I finally got around to being on the show. And it was a blast. Thanks for talking to me, Mary. Love
cool.
it. Well, right on.
Yeah. So I encourage everyone to check out West End Phoenix at westendphoenix.com and Dave Bandini at instagram.com/DaveBandini.
Supposed to be the sign. Joey pulled himself to his feet, pulled his body back up the bank, and looked back down there. He said the water was not that deep, but I almost drowned there. You can drown in a bathtub, so they say. Decided to skip the day. Hey, 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 skip the day. I tried to look casual, sneaking round the back. As a shot put across the track, and to the gate beside that board of bolts.